Welcome to Distrospect's 2010 Christmas Special. We'll introduce you to some carols you probably haven't heard in a while. And from 1994, a story that hasn't changed much, of some people who, while they have shelter, are forbidden the human grace to enjoy it, even at Christmas. Today at Distrospect, we welcome Deb Sherman with the Mental Health Rights Coalition. Deb, what's your title there?
Executive Director.
Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're going to talk to us today about second-level lodging and proposed cutbacks that the city is making.
Yeah, the city was proposing some cutbacks to residential care facilities, which includes second-level lodging homes, and to the numbers of subsidies that these homes have as part of their budget process. Staff from the city were asked to make cuts of 10% and 15% in the various departments, and this is what the public health department in charge of residential care facilities had come up with, was that they planned to cut the residential care facility subsidized beds from to immediately to 912 and then to 869.
Now, I understand that these are 20-cent beds. For every dollar spent on these beds, the city only spends 20 cents. Why on earth would they cut them back?
Because they were over the number. They are subsidized from the province, like you say, an 80-20 split. They are subsidized for 869 spaces. They were well beyond that. The city has for years carried more than that. And of the over, they have carried 100%. And they felt that, you know, to be fiscally responsible, it was time to cut the extras.
How long has that number stood, that 869, do you know?
To tell you the truth, I do not know that. It's been quite some time. I know that the city at times got up to 1,200 beds.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, they were carrying a heavy load, and they needed to find ways of cutting that back. What they did, though, was they announced that it would be 869, and then halfway through the process, they decided that they would be going down to 800, which really, in effect, meant that the city would be losing, or the people would be losing more services, because they would be losing 69 more beds than what they are funded to have. So they would lose the city's 20%, but at the same time, they would be losing 80% of provincial dollars for those spaces. So that kind of came halfway through the cutting process that they were going to talk about going down to 800.
And so they wanted to save 20% bad enough that they were going to put people out in the cold. That was the proposal.
For the other 80.
Yeah.
That was the proposal.
And they repealed that. They're going to
stick with
the provincial maximum. And I understand they attempt to achieve that by attrition. They're hoping not that they don't have to put anybody out, that as people leave, even if it takes a number of years, they'll get down to that 869 number. What they're going to do is they're going to stop taking new applications.
That's correct.
Where are these people going to go?
They're going to the Wesley and the Salvation Army and the other homeless shelters simply because there is not an alternative. There is not the capacity for them to go into different models of housing, like supportive and supported housing. Who are these people?
Who are going to the Wesley and the Salvation Army and who are now accommodated in second-level lodging homes?
There are people who are mentally ill. They are people who have other disabilities, aged people, seniors.
Really?
Those homes have seniors in them, and a lot of people with mental illnesses. Or people who just choose not to live alone.
It can be a choice to go to a second-level lodging home as opposed to accommodation. With
people
a certain level of disability, you have a choice? Is that it?
People can pay. No, anybody could walk in and pay their own way.
Oh.
And choose to live there.
All right. I understand that there is a certain fixed income associated with housing
with the
in
subsidy.
These homes. When somebody enters a second-level lodging home, do they assume a certain level of income? No, you said they can go in privately if they have their own income. If they don't have their own income, do they forfeit whatever income they have?
They're usually on a disability pension or an old age pension or some kind of pension.
And most of it goes to the home?
Yeah. The person gets the person who's on a subsidized space gets $112 of their own spending money.
So whether they're
it's called a personal needs allowance.
So whether they're getting $500 a month from the government or they're getting $1,000 a month from the government, the home takes it all but $112.
Well, I think everybody gets about the same. I believe it's around $9-something.
Well, that would be a maximum.
Yeah.
But whatever it is, whatever different amount they get, whether it's different by a few bucks or a lot of bucks, the home soaks up the difference and they get this fixed remainder, this 112?
Yeah, the 112 is the personal needs allowance, which is supposed to provide extras. They aren't extras. They're basic needs. Shampoo, toilet paper.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very small amount of money.
It is.
Given that there are different people in different situations can volunteer to go into these homes, you've mentioned to me before the interview that this is a one-size-fits-all model of housing. Is it appropriate for all these people?
No, it's not. That's the trouble that we have is that in Hamilton, because we had a provincial psychiatric hospital, and still, to all intents and purposes, do. It's now taken over by St. Joe's, and it's still a mental health center. But because we had that, we developed in Hamilton a number of services in the community so that people from other communities coming in ended up staying in Hamilton because other communities chose not to allow to have those residential care facilities in their neighborhoods. So we end up with people coming from, you know, various, all throughout the catchment area. They end up staying here in Hamilton and partaking of the services that
communities that can't afford this 20% decline.
Yeah. Oh, well, they just, or they didn't want it in their backyard.
NIMBY, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And so Hamilton ends up footing the bill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right.
So traditionally, we ended up putting in a lot of money into the custodial care model, residential care facilities, also known in some cases as second-level lodging homes.
Custodial care implies a certain level of ongoing commitment and ongoing care. It doesn't seem to imply, as we've discussed, it doesn't seem to imply recovery or getting well. Is this part of the inappropriateness of the model?
Yes, it is. There, in a custodial care model, your food is cooked, your meals are presented to you, your laundry is done. It engenders helplessness. People can spend a lot of time in hospital, and hospital staff will spend a lot of time helping people learn life skills. Then you go into one of these homes where there's no opportunity to put them into practice. People lose their, it's anti-recovery in a lot of ways. For some people, it's necessary. For some people need that level of custodial care. And it's good for them, and they're happy in that kind of care because they need it. There's other people who could move on, but they can't because there's nowhere to move on to.
You've mentioned there are other models of housing, of which we have too few in Hamilton, supported housing and supportive housing. Can you draw the distinction between the two for us?
In a custodial care model, people are viewed as patients or clients. Everything is done for them. They have very little choice about where they go. The subsidy that they have is attached to the place. When you get into supportive and supported housing models, there's an increase in the amount of client choice. The subsidy is delinked from the housing and linked to the person instead.
Is that in both models?
More so in the supported model. In the supported model, the subsidy goes with the person, the services go with the person. So you could be living, depending on your need, in, for example, a very intense 24-hour staffed facility or apartment building where you don't have cooking facilities. But if you don't need that, there's other choices where you've got an apartment and perhaps the choice of a cafeteria in the building. And then there's other models where they just simply have head leases and the services are mobile. So that if you need, you know, contact with someone daily to make sure you're taking your meds, that someone comes to you. You don't need to live in a protected home for that.
So what you're saying is that a lot of people are in this custodial model, this second-level lodging model, inappropriately for lack of the other models of housing.
Exactly.
And is this a problem with provincial and national housing policy? Have we just simply not provided for them? Is this something that's persisted simply through inertia, or is this... Is this designed in some way to keep people immobile and unwell?
I don't think it's designed to keep people mobile and unwell. I think that's the effect of lack of design. I think that we don't have a national housing policy. We don't have a minister of housing. We don't have affordable housing being built anymore. Any attempts to, the occasional group gets together to talk about building affordable housing, and by the time they've gotten their government grants and everything and come up with what they've built, it ends up being condos. So, affordable housing just isn't happening, and that's the key right there. Affordable housing and supported housing. The government needs to put more money into supported housing and not as much into custodial care, because that's not where the people really want to be. It's not where they do well.
Right. Well, we've spoken about how they do well and some of the limits that are placed on doing well in second-level lodging homes, and that it's not an empowering model at all. You spoke to me about the impediments, for instance, built into the $112 personal needs allowance.
Yeah. that personal needs allowance is, people are, in some cases, and depending, I don't want to badmouth lodging homes as a blanket statement, but some of them are better than others. Some of them are delivering.
So that 112 has to cover different things depending where you are.
Oh, yeah, depending where you are. Like some of them don't even put toilet paper in the washrooms. The residents we like to call them tenants, have to provide, you know, keep it in their rooms and their soap and carry it back and forth. So just very basic things like that they're having to pay for. And God help them if they smoke, which many of them do.
That could be expensive on $112.
Oh, yeah. And which is why you see
what's a carton now?
Panhandling.
What's a carton now?
A carton of cigarettes?
Yeah.
Oh, I wouldn't know.
I have a feeling it's around, it's $7 a pack, so a carton's got to be around $50-$60.
Yeah.
Out of 112. Yeah. And that's if you smoke a carton a month and not a carton a week.
That's right.
Yeah. And you say this drives people to panhandling.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. It's also, you'll see people who live in some of the lodging homes will supplement their diet by going to the food banks or the food programs, like Out of the Cold and
can they
places
cook?
Like that.
Can they cook where they live?
Not usually. And okay. And sometimes, you know, there are landlords who do want to let people do things like that.
Right.
There are landlords who do let people make themselves a coffee, you know, go make yourself a piece of toast. But they also run up against bylaw regulations and health regulations. So if the person, you know, isn't cleaning up after themselves properly, they've got that to deal with. So it's a whole systemic sort of goofiness that leads to people
providing them with too much care and then creating too many barriers as a result.
Yeah.
I understand that it's often the situation that there's no privacy, that there's no locks on the doors, bedroom doors, no storage.
Yeah, there's a few lodging homes that have some private rooms with locks and closets. There's others where you share a room with one person or maybe three other people.
And not of your choice.
Not necessarily of your choice. No,
right.
Can't be. I mean, operators do try to put together people that are going to get along well. It's in everyone's interest to do that. It doesn't always work, but no locks on the bedroom doors, no lockable storage, no privacy.
So suppose, despite this model, that you start getting better, and you decide you want to work your way out of this. You're living with several other people in a room. You have no privacy. You have no money. How do you do it? What do you do? Meals are fixed, right? So you've got to build a job around your meal times. Is that true?
Yeah, in a lot of lodging homes, the meal times are compressed, I guess, to make the most of staff availability. So breakfast will be, you know, 8 or 9 o'clock. Lunch will be 11. And most commonly, dinner is at 4. So if people are going out and looking for part-time jobs or even just out to do activities, in a lot of places they won't save your dinner for you. So if you don't make it home, you're out of luck.
So
it makes it difficult for people to try.
Yeah, self-reliance is discouraged.
Yes.
because of the custodial nature of the care.
Yeah.
I understand that our residents also almost lost a bus pass in this latest round of city budget cuts.
Yeah,
that's been reinstated.
They have reinstated the bus passes. I can't stress how important that is. People have to be able to move about in their society in order to be part of it. As long as people are unable to get around, all they can do is stay in the lodging homes. Now, it's only recently that, you know, lodging homes used to tell everybody, you know, get out in the morning, don't come back till dinner time. I mean, that was the standard way of doing things, and the bylaws have kind of addressed that. But so they can't sort of make them go out and be in the streets all day anymore. But still, people are given bus passes in order to get to their medical appointments and things like that, or bus tickets to get to medical appointments. But sometimes in order to get those bus passes, they have to promise to do all kinds of things like volunteering. And I consider it...
Oh, so they're not just free?
Not to everyone.
Oh, okay.
I mean, to the people in lodging homes, I mean, if you're getting a bus pass, obviously you're going to be able to do whatever you want with it. You know, other people
are they all getting them?
No, not everyone gets one.
Oh, I see. So sometimes there, in fact, often there are conditions attached.
Well, I don't know the criteria for getting one, but it's a subsidy that has existed and that we need much more of. You have to recognize the importance of mobility to wellness and the ability to decide that, you know, it's not only important to be able to make your medical appointments. That's not what's going to make you well. It's important also to be able to go visit mom once in a while. It's important to be able to just go downtown and look through the library. You know, all of these parts of society that you can't access if you aren't mobile. People need to be allowed the right to access those things.
We have this startling model then of, on the one hand, acute care, and on the other hand, custodial care. Acute care is for people who can be fixed, and custodial care is for people who can't. But it seems to be a model which allows for a very limited and dim view of the dignity of human autonomy and the resilience of recovery. This has been in place, you've told me, since the 50s and 60s when hospitals began to be cut back. There are forces, however, that are working to improve this. You mentioned a task force and a report that came forward recently.
The province formed a number of task forces with a central task force, the Ministry Implementation Task Force, to look into mental health issues. There were 9 of them formed across the province, and each one was given its mandate and asked us to address a similar set of issues. I was very pleased that in this region, the task force adopted a recovery philosophy as its basic tenet, and that it was extremely consultative. They were quite exhaustive in who they consulted with. Part of the thing that the task forces were instructed to do was look into housing. And the local task force, through the DHC, District Health Council, did that. The local District Health Council did an exhaustive study, lots of consultations, focus groups with consumers, looking into all of these issues. The task force basically instructed all of the district health councils not to come forward with recommendations, just come forward with a picture, a snapshot, the numbers, what's the situation. Our local district health council chose to do recommendations. So they worked very closely with the Supported Housing Coordination Network and came up with not only the numbers, but recommendations as well for them to take or leave But I think it was important that they made that choice. It shows the kind of collaboration we have in this community. There are people in this community working together, usually through the Supported Housing Coordination Network. That's where most of the players come together at the table and try to approach things in a concerted way, so that if we have rumors that money is going to be let loose from somewhere, we get together and come up with a group proposal rather than everyone running out and competing for the dollars with their own little proposals. We sort of all sit down and say, okay, you know, here's what the consumers want, here's what this group can offer, here's what we think we can pull together as a group, and we can sort of collaborate on this and come forth with a proposal that is best suited to everyone. So that's one of the encouraging things about this community, and that kind of work is going on right now.
It sounds like a good use of community resources, given that the money's only 20% of the solution at the moment and doesn't look like changing anytime soon, that the knowledge comes locally and that the money comes provincially.
That's right. And we are simply hoping that the task force has probably made some very good recommendations around housing and housing that consumers can and will live in. And we're hoping that those recommendations will be followed. I would like to see consumers vote more. People who live
just
in,
vote more.
Well, people who consumers, yeah. I would like to see the people who are living in the shelters
show up
organized to come out to the polls. I think it's important to recognize that with these budget cuts, I was very encouraged to see the number of ordinary folks who were writing letters to the editor, and some of them were saying, you know, I'll pay more taxes. You know, like, let's not endanger people. I'll pay more taxes. It's always the ultimate solution, isn't it? That to hold your provincial representatives accountable for what they do and what their bureaucracy does.
And for your tenants, this goes full circle again. The right kind of housing is the foundation of everything else that they need.
Definitely. Housing is the key to wellness. It's the first step. To be adequately housed is the first very most important step in achieving a higher level of wellness. That was what alarmed me when the province did some consultation a couple of years ago around homes for people with special needs. And one of the key phrases in what they were asking us to address was, like, this is housing for people who have reached their maximum potential. And that phrase disturbed me very much, because when do you decide that someone has reached their maximum potential? And when you feel that they have, then what do? You offer them nothing more. And that's what I feel is the problem with our local housing, is that we had, back when this model of housing was set up, before anything else had been considered and researched and found to be better, that was what we offered, and that's what we still continue to offer. We're sort of stuck in this, well, this is how we've always been doing it. We need to get away from that and start recognizing that, and people do recognize, and the province does recognize, that supported housing works better, that it's more cost effective, but where do you get the cash to set it up, to get it going? It's that huge investment that's required, that up front in order to set it up. But in the long run, it's going to be more cost efficient. It's going to make people more well. It's going to turn them into contributors to society.
Presumably, that's where the money eventually comes from, even if it's not there up front. Presumably, it's a pay-for-itself proposition. If we got our pencils out and we were going to write to who used to be Chris Hodgson, I guess now it's Helen Johns, then it sounds like what we want is the consumer in the driver's seat here.
Definitely. There's no point in trying to invent systems for people without consulting the people.
I think that about wraps it up. I really appreciate you coming in here to talk about it, Deb, and about wellness and human resilience.
Thanks.
Appreciate you coming in.
Appreciate being here.
Today, the same underprivileged living in lodging homes have $120 a month for clothing, entertainment, travel, personal needs, and all the other things we take for granted.
In the Way, a poem by Robert Service. I'm just a fossilized old scout, a living in the past. I see folks try to figure out how long I'm like to last. I've had my share of weal and woe. I'm 90 old today, and somehow I begin to know I'm kinda in the way. They leave me cuddling up the cat, deep in my old armchair, and loudly talk of this and that, as if I wasn't there. I reckon it's time they took my carcass to the clay, for I can see the way folks look. I'm only in the way. I've lived too long. I feel I should make up my mind to go. My sense of hearing ain't too good. My sight is getting low. There's no one kind of wanting me, and I can only pray the Lord won't think, if heaven be, old grandpop's in the way.
Oh. White Christmas. My folks, they think I'm serving maid each time I visit home. They do not dream I ply a trade as old as Greece or Rome. For if they found I fouled their name and was not white as snow, I'm sure that they would die of shame. Please God, they'll never know. I clean the paint from off my face in sober black I dress. Of coquetry I leave no trace to give them vague distress. And though it causes me a pang to play such sorry tricks, about my neck I meekly hang a silver crucifix. And so with humble step I go, just like a child again, to greet their Christmas candle glow, a soul without a stain. So while I play my contrite part and make myself believe, there's not a stain within my heart on holy Christmas Eve. With double natures we're vexed, and what we feel we are. A saint one day, a sinner next, a red light or a star, a prostitute or proselyte, and each part sincere. So I become a Westall White, one week in every year. For this I say without demur, from out life's lurid lore, each righteous woman has in her a tincture of the whore. While every harpy of the night, as I have learned too well, holds in her heart a heaven light to ransom her from hell. So I'll go home and sweep and dust. I'll make the kitchen fire and be of model daughters just, the best they could desire. I'll fondle them, I cook their food, and mother dear will say, thank God my darling is as good as when she went away. But after New Year's Day I'll fill my bag, and though they grieve, I bid them both goodbye until another Christmas Eve. And then a knock upon the door, I'll find them waiting there. An angel-like I'll come once more in answer to their prayer. Then lo, one night when candlelight glimpses mystic on the snow, and music swells of Christmas bells, I'll come no more to go. The old folks need my love and care, their gold shall gild my dross, and evermore my breast shall bear my little silver cross.
Conversation from the number 118. She jumped up the steps of the number 118 Herdman Station bus at the middle doors, shouting simultaneously to the bus driver at the front, "Do you stop at Herdman Station?" She repeated herself loudly when there was no instant reply. Finally, the driver shouted back an affirmative reply. Relieved, she half fell, half threw herself into the seat next to me. The bus lunged onward. Her eyes were bright blue like summer cornflowers. Her light-colored hair was pulled back in a ponytail. Trails of honey strands framed her face. Panicking, she suddenly began searching the bus floor. Did I drop something? By this time, every passenger in the vicinity of our seat was involved in this young girl's plight. Everyone anxious to get her settled so they could resume reading or daydreaming. The passenger said no emphatically. She bowed her head down toward her chest and, slightly raising her face, said rather slowly and matter-of-factly to whomever was still listening, "I'm having a bad day." I felt a surreal experience coming on, and my fate was sealed. As I was the passenger sitting next to her, she began to engage me in a very honest, brutally sensitive conversation. "My mother calls me retarded, and my brothers call me retarded too. I wish they wouldn't call me that." There was a very dramatic pause. One could hear the feet of some of the passengers shuffling uncomfortably and papers shaking with discomfort. She turned her head and stared directly at me with all the intensity of her innocence. Then she fired the loaded question my way. "Do you think I'm retarded?" I searched inside myself and felt helpless. I looked back at her and decided that the only way to converse with this engaging young person was eye to eye and heart to heart. "No," I firmly said, as I looked at her, and I meant it, because long ago I had discarded such demeaning attempt to box people in a negative category. Then I added a cliche that I thought would be a segue out of the silence that followed my reply. "Everyone is unique. We all have our gifts, and you have your gifts too." She was fully capable of understanding this idea, and to my relief, completed my thought by adding, "Yes, and nobody's perfect. But my mother says I can't get married because I'm retarded," she added. I replied that that wasn't necessarily true. When the right person and with loving support, it can happen. In the back of my mind, a secondary analysis was occurring as I wondered what kind of mother would say such negative things to a daughter who was courageously trying to find her own place in the world. A daughter obviously dealing with emotional abuse. She lamented that her brothers call a friend with Down syndrome retarded. "He is my friend, and he is not a retard either," she loudly complained. She called to a smiling young man sitting across the aisle. "Hi, Michael. You're my friend, and you don't think I'm retarded either, do you?" I wish I could change families. "Well," I stated the facts blandly, "we are born into a family, but we can choose our friends." In an attempt to comfort her about her siblings' teasing, I said, "Maybe when your brothers are a little older, they won't tease you." I surmised they must be younger than her and thoughtless. I recklessly steered the conversation in the wrong direction when I asked, "How old are your brothers?" "Oh, 29 and 27, she replied. I mentally froze and remembered reading about 6-year-old Jeffrey Baldwin, who starved to death with 6 other adults in the house, privy to the dire circumstances and the horror of his isolation. Of course, his was an extreme situation. All the same, abuse is abuse is abuse. It was like she read my mind, because she then said, "I hate going home every day. I like going to work. I never have a bad day at work. I work at the food bank 5 days a week, every afternoon for 2 hours. I like the work, but it's not enough time." "Well," I replied, "it's really good you have that. And maybe one day your brothers will treat you better." After a minute of silence, she stared at me again. "I wish I could be in your family." I felt complimented, but at a loss. The bus suddenly tipped to the left, the familiar clue that we were approaching Herdman Station. With the same impetuous energy with which she alighted on the bus, she jumped up. "Can I buy you a coffee?" she asked. "Well, I am on my way home," I replied. "I can't stop today. Maybe another day." Then she completely blew me away, as she intently looked at me and softly asked, "Are you going to worry about me?" My first inclination was to respond yes, as deep inside I wanted to mother her and change her situation. But instead, I gave an answer that hopefully would plant a thought that could take root and grow. "No," I replied firmly, to calm my own apprehension, "because I know that you can take care of yourself." She peered deeply into my eyes. The answer seemed to please her, because her face lit up in a gigantic smile. The bus doors opened, and she was gone.
Pain by Elsie Robinson. Why must I be hurt? Suffering and despair, cowardice and cruelty, envy and injustice, all of these hurt. Grief and terror, loneliness and betrayal, and the agony of loss or death, all these things hurt. Why? Why must life hurt? Why must those who love generously, live honorably, feel deeply, all that is good and beautiful be so hurt, while selfish creatures go unscathed? That is why. Because they can feel. Hurt is the price to pay for feeling. Pain is not an accident, nor punishment, nor mockery by some savage god. Pain is a part of growth. The more we grow, the more we feel. The more we feel, the more we suffer. For if we are able to feel beauty, we must also feel the lack of it. Those who glimpse heaven are bound to sight hell. To have felt deeply is worth anything at cost. To have felt love and honor, courage and ecstasy is worth any price. And so, since hurt is the price of larger living, I will not hate pain, nor try to escape it. Instead, I will try to meet it bravely, bear it proudly, not as a cross or a misfortune, but an opportunity, a privilege, a challenge to the God that gropes within me.
Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
Here's a sentimental favorite of mine by Edgar Guest. The title, The Mother Watch. She never closed her eyes in sleep till we were all in bed. On party nights till we came home, she often sat and read. We little thought about it then when we were young and gay. How much mother worried when we children were away. We only knew she never slept when we were out at night, and that she waited just to know that we'd come home all right. Why, sometimes when we stayed away till one or two or three, it seemed to us that mother heard the turning of the key. For always when we stepped inside, she'd call and we'd reply. But we were all too young back then to understand just why. Until the last one had returned, she always kept a light, for mother couldn't sleep until she kissed us all good night. She had to know that we were safe before she went to rest. She seemed to fear the world might harm the one she loved the best. And once she said, "When you are grown, to women and to men, perhaps I'll sleep the whole night through. I might be different then." And so it seemed that night and day, we knew a mother's care, that always when we got back home, we'd find her waiting there. Then came the night that we were called to gather round her bed. "The children all are with you now," the kindly doctor said. And in her eyes there gleamed again the old-time tender light that told that she'd been waiting just to know we were all right. She smiled that old familiar smile and prayed for God to keep us safe from harm throughout the years, and then she went to sleep. This poem was written by Edgar Guest at the turn of the century. It's titled Storytelling. Most every night when they're in bed and both their little prayers have said, they shout for me to come upstairs and tell them tales of grizzly bears and Indians and gypsies bold and eagles with claws that hold a baby's weight and fairy sprites that roam the woods on starry nights. And I must illustrate these tales, must imitate the northern gales that toss the Indian's canoe and show the way he paddles too. If in the story comes a bear, I have to pause and sniff the air and show the way he climbs the trees to steal the honey from the bees. And then I buzz like angry bees and sting him on the nose and knees and howl in pain till mother cries. That pair will never close their eyes. With all the noise up there you make, you're simply keeping them awake. And then they whisper, "Just one more." And once again, I'm forced to roar. A new story's every night, they ask, and that is not an easy task. I have to be so many things, the frog that croaks, the lark that sings, the cunning fox, the frightened hen. But just last night they stumped me when they wanted me to twist and squirm and imitate an angleworm. At last they tumble off to sleep, and softly from their room I creep and brush and comb the shock of hair I tossed about to be a bear. Then mother says, "Well, I should say, you're just as much a child as they. But you can bet I'll not resign this storytelling job of mine."
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue@radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.